Finally, growled Tactical Molly, who sat next to Ensign Molly, wearing a gold uniform almost identical to Captain Molly's. She'd been sitting there doing absolutely nothing and looking bored the entire time I'd been there. Now she turned and started jabbing buttons, and cheesy sound effects filled the bridge. Minimal damage, reported Science Molly. The bridge rocked again, and we staggered. One of the panels exploded in a shower of sparks. Some Molly in a red uniform who hadn't spoken crashed limply to the deck.
Not real, Ensign Molly said. Sorry, my bad. Some things you just can't get rid of.
Damage alarms started wailing. They sounded like a badly distorted version of a young woman screaming. Shields have failed, Captain, Science Molly reported. And she reached for the Omega Bomb. No, I snapped. Stop her! Captain Molly took one look at me and then leapt at Science Molly. She seized the Omega Bomb. Stop, she ordered. There is no room for emotion here, snapped Science Molly. It's over. This is all you can do to protect them. I gave you an order, snapped Captain Molly. You're letting your fear control you, replied Science Molly coldly. This is the only logical way. Captain Molly screamed in incoherent rage and slugged Science Molly in the face. Science Molly screamed back and swung a fist into Captain Molly's stomach. Music started playing, loud, high-pitched, strident. Most would recognize it.
Sorry, Ensign Molly called, cringing.
I hurried forward to grab at the struggling Mollies, and my hands went right through them. Right, I was an observer here. Welcome, sure, but if I wanted to control what was going on, I had to do it the hard way, like Corpse Taker was doing. I turned to Ensign Molly and said, "Damn it, do something."
There's nothing I can do, she said, her eyes uncertain and full of sadness. They've been like that ever since they killed you.
I stared at Molly and felt my mouth fall open. Time stopped. The door. The old wooden door. The cabinet where Molly had kept her suicide device. I turned toward them. My godmother's voice echoed in my head.
You are currently freed of the shackles of mortality. Your limited brain no longer impedes access to that record. The only blocks to your memory are those you allow to be.
I remembered the door, the cabinet. I remembered the past. Sonya had insisted that they keep me on the backboard when they carried me into St. Mary of the Angels after my apartment burned down. The dark-skinned Knight of the Cross carried me from his minivan and into the church alone, toting the board and my couple of 100 pounds in change on one shoulder, as if I'd been a big sack of doggy chow. Molly had gone ahead of him, worried, speaking rapidly to someone. I wasn't sure who, one of the priests, I guessed. I hurt everywhere I could feel, and in the places I couldn't feel, I only wished I could hurt. My body, from the waist down, had stopped talking to me altogether. I'd fallen off a ladder while trying to get some of my elderly neighbors out of the burning building and landed on a stone planter. Landed bad and on my back. I've gotten lucky occasionally. This time I hadn't. I knew what the fall, the point of impact, and the lack of sensation in my lower body meant. I'd broken my back. The Red King had my daughter. I was the only one who was going to do anything about it, and I'd fallen and broken my back. Sonya carried me into the utility room that was mostly used for storage, particularly for storing a battered wizard and his friends when they needed the refuge the church offered. There were a number of folding cots in the room stored for use. Sonya set me down, rolled out a cot, put some sheets on it, and then placed me on the cot, backboard and all. Might as well leave me on the floor, I told him. I'm lying on a board either way. Pfft, Sonya said, his dark, handsome face lighting up with a white grin. I do not care to clean the floor after you leave. Someone else can do the sheets. Says you, I said. You smell like burning hair. Some of it was on fire, he said cheerfully. His eyes, though, were less jovial. He put a hand on my chest and said, You are badly hurt. Yeah. You want a drink? He asked. One hand hovered near his jacket's breast pocket, where I knew he kept his flask. Pass, maybe I'll just cope instead. He made another disgusted noise and produced said flask, took a swig from it, and winked at me. I was never clear on the difference, da? Molly appeared in the doorway, and Sonya looked at her.
He's on the way, Molly said. Her voice was strained. Her day hadn't been as bad as mine, but she still looked shaken.
Sonya offered Molly a pull from the flask. She shook her head. Very good, the big Russian said. I will talk to Fortil, tell him what is happening.
Sonya, Molly said, putting a hand on his arm. Thank you.
He gave her a wide grin. Perhaps it was just a coincidence I arrived when I did. Molly rolled her eyes and gave him a faint shove toward the door. It didn't move the big man, but he went, and Molly flicked on a little lamp and shut the door behind him. She walked over to me and took a couple of KFC wet wipes from her bag. She knelt down next to the cot, opened them, and started cleaning my face. I closed my eyes and said nothing. My little girl was going to die. My little girl was going to die. And there was nothing I could do about it. Oh, I'd been defeated before. People had even died because I'd failed. But those people had never been my own flesh and blood. They hadn't been my child. I'd lost. I was beaten. This was all over. And it was all your fault, Harry. If I'd been faster, if I'd been smarter, if I'd been strong enough of mind to make the hard choices, to focus on saving Maggie first and everyone else second. But I hadn't been. I'd been insufficient to the challenge, and she was going to die because of it. I broke. Right there. I just broke. The task given to me had been more than I could bear, and what followed would be nothing but torturous regret. I'd failed my own child. My chest convulsed. I made a sound, and my eyes filled until I couldn't see.
Molly sat beside me, patiently cleaning my face and neck with her wipes. I must have had soot on my face. When I could see again, there were large patches of gray and black on the wipes, and my face felt cold and tingled slightly.
I've got to help her, I said quietly. Harry, don't. Don't twist the knife in your own wound, Molly replied. Right now, you need to stay calm and quiet until Butters can look at you.
I wish you hadn't gotten him involved, I said.
I didn't even ask him, she said. I got halfway through the first sentence and he asked where you were. Then he said he'd come see you.
I shook my head.
No, I mean... I drew a deep breath. Kid, I've got to cross a line.
Molly froze, one hand still extended. I'm not getting up off this bed alone, I said quietly. It's my only option.
You run in the circles I do, you get more than a few offers of power. It always comes with a price, usually a hidden one, but you get the offers. I'd had more than a few chances to advance myself, provided I was willing to set aside anything like integrity to do so. I hadn't been. Not until today.
Who? Molly asked simply. My mouth twitched at one corner.
One is a lot like another, I said.
She shook her head.
But if you go over to one of them, they'll make me into a monster, I said quietly, sooner or later.
She wouldn't look at me.
I can't let that happen, I said. For all I know, I could turn into something that would hurt Maggie myself. But maybe I can use them to get her out of danger.
She inhaled sharply and looked up at me.
It's got to be Mab, I said. She's wicked smart, but she isn't omniscient or infallible. I've swindled fairies before. I can do it again.
She inhaled sharply.
You're going to be the Winter Knight? She shook her head. What if she doesn't? I mean, what if she won't?
I let out a low chuckle. Oh, she'll do it. If I go to her, she'll do it. She's been after me long enough.
I don't understand, Molly said. She'll twist you. change you. It's what they do. I fumbled and put one of my hands on hers. Malls, whatever happens, I'm not going to make it out of this one. She stared at me for a minute. Then she shook her head. She shook her head and silent tears fell from her eyes. Ollie, I said again, patting her hand. Kid, for everything there is a season.
Don't, she said. Don't you dare quote the Bible at me, not to justify this.
Bible, I said. I was quoting the birds. She burst out in a huffing sound that was both a laugh and sob. Look, Malls, nothing lasts forever, nothing. And if I've got to choose between myself and my daughter, there's not even a choice. You know that. She bowed her head and wept harder, but I saw her nod just a little. I need your help, I said. She looked up at me, bloodshot eyes a mess. I'm going to arrange things, but Mab's going to be wary of me. She knows my history, and if I know what's going on, she'll be able to tell I'm lying to her. I don't have enough of a poker face for that.
No,
Molly said, sniffing and briskly swiping at her eyes.
You don't. You still suck at lying, boss.
To the people who know me, maybe, I said, smiling. Do you understand what I'm asking you to do? She bit her lip and said,
Do you? Have you thought what it's going to mean for me once you're...
Dead, I said quietly. I think Ebenezer or Injun Joe will take over for me, continue your training. They both know how strongly I felt about sheltering you from the council's judgment. She looked suddenly exhausted. She shook her head slightly.
That's not what I meant.
Oh, I said. Molly had crushed on me since she was a teenager. I hadn't really thought anything of it. I mean, it had been going on for years, and crushes probably didn't last for years, did they? They faded. Molly's feelings hadn't, but I didn't reciprocate them. I loved her to pieces, but I was never going to be in love with her. Especially not if I was dead, I guess. If our positions had been reversed, that might have been kind of hard for me to accept, too. I patted her hand again awkwardly and said, I'm sorry that I wasn't here longer, that it couldn't be more than it was.
You never did anything wrong by me, Harry, she said.
She lifted her chin and met my eyes again.
This isn't about me, though, is it?
It's about Maggie. She nodded, and I saw steel enter her spine.
So, of course, I'll help you.
I lifted her fingers to my mouth and put a gentle kiss on them. You're one hell of a woman, Molly, I said. Thank you. She shivered, then she said, How do you want to do it? Bring me a phone, I said. Need to make a call. You stay out of it. It'll be better if you don't know.
Okay, she said. Then?
Then you come back in here, put me to sleep. You take the memory of this conversation and the phone call out of my head.
How?
She asked. If I leave any obvious holes, it could hurt you, and it might be visible to something as powerful as Mab. I thought about it for a moment and said, I nodded off in the van on the way here. Set it up so that I was never awake once I was here, until I wake up after. She thought about it and said,
It could work. If I do it slowly enough, it might not leave a ripple.
Do it like that, then. She stood up. She walked over to a battered old wooden cabinet on the wall and opened it. Among other things, there was an old freestanding rotary phone inside it, attached to a long extension cord. A makeshift line that Fort Hill had run through the drywall from the next room. She brought the phone to me and set it carefully on my chest. Then she walked to the similarly battered old wooden door.
You realize, she said, that I could change this, Harry. Could find out who you were using to kill yourself. I could take it right out of your head and call them off. You'd never know.
You could do that, I said quietly. And I feel like an utter bastard for asking this of you, Grasshopper, but I don't have anyone else to ask.
You should call Thomas, she said. He deserves the truth.
Thomas, my brother, my family. He'd be one of little Maggie's only blood relations once I was gone. And Molly was right, he did deserve the truth. No, I said, barely louder than a whisper. Tell him later, if you want. After. If you tell him before that, he won't stand for it. He'll try to stop it.
And maybe he'd be right to do it.
No, I said quietly, he wouldn't. But he'd do it anyway. This is my choice, Malls.
She turned to go and paused. You've never called me Malls before today.
Was saving it, I said.
For when you weren't my apprentice anymore.
Wanted to try it out.
She smiled at me. She shed one more tear. And then she left. It took me a moment to gather myself. Then I dialed an international number on the rotary phone.
Kincaid, answered a flat voice.
It's Dresden, I said. The voice warmed very slightly.
Harry, what's up?
I took a deep breath. You owe me a favor, I said quietly, for that thing with Ivy on the island.
Damn right, he said.
I'm calling it in.
Okay, he said. You want some backup on something?
I have a target for you. There was a silence from the other end of the phone. Then he said,
tell me.
The new winter night, I said.
There's a new one?
There's going to be, I said.
How do you... More silence. Then he said, it's like that.
There's a good reason, I said.
Yeah?
There's a little girl.
More silence. You'll know it's coming.
No, I said. I won't. I'll see to it.
Okay, he said. When?
They were going to kill my daughter sometime before the next sunrise. I figured it might take me some time to get her home, assuming I didn't die trying. Anytime after noon tomorrow, I said. The sooner the better.
Okay.
You can find me?
Yeah.
Be sure, I said. I pay my debts. I sighed again.
Yeah.
Thanks.
He let out a soft chuckle. Thanking me, he said. That's new.
He hung up. I did the same. Then I called for Molly. Okay, I said. Let's do this. Molly took the phone and put it back in the cabinet. Then she picked up a slender, new white candle in a holder and a small box of matches. She came over and set the candle on a folding table nearby, where I could see it without moving my head. She struck a match and lit it. All right, she said. Harry, this has to be a smooth, gentle job, so focus on the candle. I need you to still your mind so that I can work. It felt odd letting the grasshopper take the lead, but I guess that was what I'd been training her to do. I focused on the candle and began to quiet my thoughts. Good, Molly said quietly after a moment, her voice soft velvet. Relax. Take a nice, slow, deep breath. Good. Listen to my voice and let me guide you. Another deep breath now. And together with my accomplice, I finished arranging my murder.
Chapter 50. I surfaced from the memory shivering and looked around in confusion. I was still in Molly's mindscape on the cheesy bridge. It was silent, completely silent. Nothing moved. The images on the screen and the various Mollies were all frozen in place like mannequins. Everything that had been happening in the battle had been happening at the speed of thought, lightning fast. There was only one reason that everything here would be stopped still like this, right in the middle of the action. So much for that linear time nonsense, huh? My voice came out sounding harsh and rough. Footsteps sounded behind me, and the room began to grow brighter and brighter. After a moment, there was nothing but white light, and I had to hold up a hand to shield my eyes against it. Then the light faded somewhat. I lifted my eyes again and found myself in a featureless expanse of white. I wasn't even sure what I was standing on, or if I was standing on anything at all. There was simply nothing but white. And
a young man with hair of dark gold that hung messily down over silver-blue eyes. His cheekbones could have sliced bread. He wore jeans, old boots, a white shirt, and a denim jacket, and no youth born had ever been able to stand with such utter tranquil stillness as he. "You're used to linear time," he said. His voice was resonant, deep, mellow, with the almost musical timbre you hear from radio personalities. It was the easiest way to help you understand.
"Aren't you a little short for an archangel?" I asked him. Uriel smiled at me. It was the sort of expression that would make flowers spontaneously blossom and babies start to giggle.
"Appropriate. I must confess to being more of a Star Wars fan than a Star Trek fan, personally. The simple division of good and evil, the clarity of perfect right and perfect wrong, it's relaxing. It makes me feel young." I just stared at him for a moment and tried to gather my thoughts. The memory, now that I had it again, was painfully vivid. God, that poor kid. Molly. I'd never wanted to cause her pain. She'd been a willing accomplice, and she'd done it with her eyes open, but God, I wished it hadn't had to happen to her. She was hurting so much, and now I could see why. And I could see why the madness she was feigning might be a great deal more genuine than she realized. That had to have been why Murphy distrusted her so strongly. Murph had excellent instincts for people. She must have sensed something in Molly, sensed the pain and the desperation that drove her, and it must have sent up a warning flag in Murphy's head, which would have hurt Molly badly to be faced with suspicion and distrust, however polite Karen might have been about it. That pain would, in turn, have driven her further away, made her act stranger, which would earn more suspicion in an agonizing cycle. I'd never wanted that for her. What had I done? I'd saved Maggie, but had I destroyed my apprentice in doing so? The fact that I'd gotten myself killed had no relative bearing on the morality of my actions, if I had. You can't just walk around picking and choosing which lives to save and which to destroy. The inherent arrogance and the underlying evil of such a thing runs too deep to be avoided, no matter how good your intentions might be. I knew why Molly had tried to get me to tell Thomas. She'd known, just as I had, that Thomas would try to stop me from killing myself, regardless of my motivations. But she'd been right about something else, too. He was my brother. He deserved more than I'd given him. That was why I hadn't thought of him, not once since returning to Chicago. How could I possibly have remembered my brother without remembering the shame I felt at excluding him from my trust? How could I think of Thomas without thinking of the truth of what I had done? Normally, I would never have believed that I was the sort of man who could make himself forget and overlook something rather than facing a harsh reality, no matter how painful it might be. I guess I'm not perfect. The young man facing me waited patiently, apparently giving me time to gather my thoughts, saying nothing. Uriel. I should have known from the outset. Uriel is the archangel who most people know little about. Most don't even know his name, and apparently he likes it that way. If Gabriel is an ambassador, if Michael is a general, if Raphael is a healer and spiritual champion, then Uriel is a spymaster, heaven's spook. Uriel covered all kinds of covert work for the Almighty. When mysterious angels showed up to wrestle with biblical patriarchs without revealing their identities, when death was visited upon the firstborn of Egypt, when an angel was sent into cities of corruption to guide the innocent clear of inbound wrath, Uriel's hand was at work. He was the quietest of the archangels. To my way of thinking, that probably indicated that he was also the most dangerous. He'd taken notice of me a few years back and had bestowed a measure of power known as soul fire on me. I'd done a job or three for him since then. He dropped by with annoying, cryptic advice once in a while. I sort of liked him, but he was also aggravating and scary in a way that I had never known before. There was the sense of something hideously absolute about him, something that would not yield or change even if the universe itself was unmade. Standing in his presence, I always felt that I had somehow become so fragile that I might fly to dust if the archangel sneezed or accidentally twitched the wrong muscle, which, given the kind of power such a being possessed, was probably more or less accurate. "All of this," I asked, waving a hand generally, "was to lead me there, to that memory?" "You had to understand." I eyed him and said wearily, "Epic fail, because I have no idea what you're talking about." Uriel tilted his head back and laughed. This is one of those things that was about the journey, not the destination. I shook my head. You lost me. On the contrary, Harry, you found yourself. I eyed him, then tore at my hair and said, "Oh, can't you give me a straight answer? Is there some law of the universe that compels you to be so freaking mysterious?" "Several, actually," Uriel said, still clearly amused, "all designed for your protection, but there are still some things I can tell you." "Then tell me why," I said. "Why do all this? Why sucker me into going back to Chicago? Why?" "Jack told you," Uriel said. "They cheated. The scale had to be balanced." I shook my head. "That office in Chicago between, it was yours?" "One of them," he said, nodding. "I have a great deal of work to do. I recruit those willing to help me." "What work?" I asked. "The same work as I ever have done," Uriel said. "I and my colleagues labor to ensure freedom." "Freedom of what?" I asked. "Of will, of choice. The distinction between good and evil is meaningless if one does not have the freedom to choose between them. It is my duty, my purpose in creation, to protect and nourish that meaning." I narrowed my eyes. "So, if you're involved in my death," I tilted my head at him, "it's because someone forced me to do it?" Uriel waggled a hand in a so-so gesture and turned to pace a few steps away. "Force implies another will overriding your own," he said over his shoulder. "But there is more than one way for your will to be compromised." I frowned at him, then said, with dawning comprehension, "Lies." The archangel turned, his eyebrows lifted, as though I were a somewhat dim student who had surprised his teacher with an insightful answer. "Yes, precisely. When a lie is believed, it compromises the freedom of your will." "So what?" I asked. "Captain Jack and the Purgatory crew ride to the rescue every time someone tells a lie?" Uriel laughed. "No, of course not. Mortals are free to lie, if they choose to do so. If they could not, they would not be free." His eyes hardened. "But others are held to a higher standard. Their lies are far deadlier, far more potent." "I don't understand," I said. "Imagine a being who was there when the first mortal drew the first breath," Uriel said. "Hard, angry flickers of light danced around us, notable even against formless white. One who has watched humanity rise from the dust to spread across and to change the very face of the world. One who has seen, quite literally, tens of thousands of mortal lives begin, wax, wane, and end." "Someone like an angel," I said quietly. "Someone like that," he said, showing his teeth briefly. "A being who could know a mortal's entire life, could know his dreams, his fears, his very thoughts. Such a being, so versed in human nature, in mortal patterns of thought, could reliably predict precisely how a given mortal would react to almost anything." Uriel gestured at me. "For example, how he might react to a simple lie delivered at precisely the right moment. Uriel waved his hand, and suddenly we were back in the utility room at St. Mary's. Only I wasn't lying on the backboard on a cot. Or rather, I was doing exactly that. But I was also standing beside Uriel at the door, looking in at myself. "Do you remember what you were thinking?" Uriel asked me. I did remember. I remembered with perfect clarity, in fact. I thought that I'd been defeated before, that people had even died because I failed. But those people had never been my own flesh and blood. They hadn't been my child. I'd lost. I was beaten. I shook my head. I remember saying to myself that it was all over, and it was all your fault, Harry. "Ah," Uriel said as I finished the last sentence, and he lifted his hand. "Now, look." I blinked at him, and then at the image of me lying on the cot. I frowned. There was something odd about the shadows in the room, but... "Here," Uriel said, lifting a hand. Light shone from it as though from a sudden sunrise. It revealed the room, casting everything in stark relief. And I saw it. A slender shadow crouched beside the cot, vague and difficult to notice even by Uriel's light, but it was there, and it was leaning as though to whisper in my ear. "And it was all your fault, Harry." The thought, the memory, resonated in my head for a moment, and I shivered. That shadow, it's an angel? "It was once," he said, and his voice was gentle and infinitely sad. "A long, long time ago." "One of the fallen," I breathed.
"Yes, who knew how to lie to you, Harry."
"Yeah, well, blaming myself for bad stuff isn't exactly completely uncharacteristic for me, man."
"I'm aware, as was that,"
he said, nodding at the shadow. "It made the lie even stronger, to use your own practice against you. But that creature knew what it was doing. It's all about timing. At that precise moment, in that exact state of mind, the single whisper it passed into your thoughts was enough to push your decision." Uriel looked at me and smiled faintly. It added enough anger, enough self-recrimination, enough guilt, and enough despair to your deliberations to make you decide that destroying yourself was the only option left to you. It took your freedom away. His eyes hardened again. "I attempt to discourage that sort of thing where possible. When I cannot, I am allowed to balance the scales."
"I still don't understand," I said. "How does me coming back to haunt Chicago for a few nights balance anything?"
"Oh, it doesn't," Uriel said. "I can only act in a mirror of the offending action, I'm afraid."
"You just get to whisper in my ear?"
"To whisper 7 words, in fact," he said. "What you did was elective."
"Elective?" I asked.
"I had no direct involvement in your return. In my judgment, it needed to happen, but there was no requirement that you come back to Chicago," Uriel said calmly. "You volunteered." I rolled my eyes.
"Well, yes, duh, because 3 of my friends were going to die if I didn't."
Uriel arched an eyebrow at me abruptly. Then he reached into the pocket of his jacket and withdrew a cell phone. He made it beep a couple of times, then turned on the speakerphone, and I heard a phone ringing.
"Murphy," answered Captain Jack's baritone.
"What's this Dresden is telling me about 3 of his friends being hurt?"
"Dresden," Jack said in an absent tone, as if searching his memory and finding nothing.
Uriel seemed mildly impatient. He wasn't buying it.
"Tall, thin, insouciant, and sent back to Chicago to search for his killer?"
"Oh, right, him," Jack said. "That guy."
"Yes," Uriel said.
There was a guileless pause, and then Jack said,
"What about him?"
Uriel, bless his angelic heart, closed his eyes for a moment and took a deep, calming breath.
"Colin," he said in a reproving, parental tone.
I might have mentioned something about it, Jack said. Sure, guy's got a lot of friends. Friends are running around fighting monsters. I figure at least three of them are going to get hurt if he isn't there to back them up. Seemed reasonable.
Call in, Uriel said, his voice touched with an ocean of disappointment and a teaspoon of anger.
You lied. I speculated, Captain Jack replied. I got him to do the right thing, didn't I?
Colin, our purpose is to defend freedom, not to decide how it should be used.
Everything I told him was technically true, more or less, and I got the job done, Jack said stubbornly.
Look, sir, if I were perfect, I wouldn't be working here in the first place, now would I?
And then he hung up, on speakerphone, on a freaking archangel.
I couldn't help it. I let out a rolling belly laugh. I just got suckered into doing this by stars and stones. You didn't even know that he... Big, bad angel boy, and you get the wool pulled over your eyes by... I stopped trying to talk and just laughed.
Uriel eyed the phone, then me, and then tucked the little device away again, clearly nonplussed.
It doesn't matter how well I believe I know your kind, Harry. They always manage to find some way to try my patience.
It took me a moment to get the laughter under control, but I did.
Look, Uri, I don't want to say...
The Archangel gave me a look so cold that my words froze in my throat. Harry Blackstone, Copperfield, Dresden, he said quietly, and he said it exactly right, speaking my name in a voice of that same absolute power that had so unnerved me before. Do not attempt to familiarize my name. The part you left off happens to be rather important to who and what I am. Do you understand?
I didn't. But as he spoke, I knew, not just suspected, but knew, that this guy could obliterate me, along with the planet I was standing on, with a simple thought. In fact, if what I'd read about archangels was right, Uriel could probably take apart all the planets, like all of them, everywhere. And I also knew that what I had just done had insulted him and frightened him. I swallowed. It took me two tries, but I managed to whisper,
"Aren't we just Mr. Sunshine today?"
Uriel blinked. He looked less than certain for a moment. Then he said, "Mr. Sunshine is perfectly acceptable, I suppose."
I nodded. "Sorry," I said, "about your name. I didn't realize it was so,
intimate," he said quietly. "Sensitive. Names have tremendous power, Dresden. Yet mortals toss them left and right as though they were toys. It's like watching infants play with hand grenades sometimes." The ghost of a smile touched his face as he glanced at me. "Some more so than others, and I forgive you, of course." I nodded at him, then after a quiet moment I asked,
"What happens now?"
"That's up to you," Uriel said. "You can always work for me. I believe you would find it challenging to do so, and I would have considerable use for someone of your talents."
"For how long?" I asked. "I mean, for guys like Captain Jack, is it forever?"
Uriel smiled. "Colin, like the others, is with me because he is not yet prepared to face what comes next. When he is, he'll take that step. For now, he is not."
"When you say what comes next, what do you mean exactly?"
"The part involving words like forever, eternity, and judgment."
"Oh," I said, "what comes next?"
"Exactly."
"So I can stay between," I said quietly, "or I can go get on that train."
"If you do," Uriel said, his eyes intent and serious, "then you accept the consequences for all that you have done while alive. When judged, what you have done will be taken into account. Your fate, ultimately, will be determined by your actions in life."
"You're saying that if I don't work for you, I'll just have to accept what comes?"
"I am saying that you cannot escape the consequences of your choices," he said. I frowned at him for a minute. Then I said, "If I get on the train, it might just carry me straight to hell."
"I can't talk to you about that," he said. What comes next is about faith, Harry, not knowledge.
I folded my arms. What if I dig the ghost routine?
You don't, Uriel replied.
But even if you did, I would point out to you that your spiritual essence has been all but disintegrated. You would not last long as a shade, nor would you have the strength to aid and protect your loved ones. Should you lose your sanity, you might even become a danger to them. But if that is your desire, I can facilitate it.
I shook my head, trying to think. Then I said,
It depends.
Upon? My friends, I said quietly. My family. I have to know that they're all right.
Uriel watched me for a moment and then opened his mouth to speak, shaking his head a little as he did.
Stop, I said, pointing a finger at him. Don't you dare tell me to make this choice in the dark. Captain Jack gave me a half-truth that sent me running around Chicago again. Another angel told me a lie that got me killed. If you really care so much about my free will, you'll be willing to help me make a free, informed choice, just as if I was a grown-up. So either admit that you're trying to push me in your own direction, or else put your principles where your mouth is, and make like the ghost of Christmas present.
He stared at me for a long moment, his brow furrowed. From your perspective. Yes, I suppose it does look that way. Then he nodded firmly and extended his arm toward me.
Take my hand. I did.
The white expanse gave way to reality once more. Suddenly I stood with Uriel inside the corpse taker's hideout, on the stairs where that final confrontation had come. Molly was at the top of the stairs, leaning back against the wall. Her body was twisting and straining, her chest heaving with desperate breaths. Blood ran from both nostrils and had filled the sclera of her eyes, turning them into inhuman-looking blue and red stones. She let out little gasps and choked screams, along with whispered snatches of words that didn't make any sense. Uriel did that thing with his hand again, and suddenly I could see Molly even more clearly, and saw that some kind of hideous mass was wound around her, like a python constricting its prey. It consisted of strands of some kind of slimy jelly, purple and black and covered with pulsing pustules that reeked of corruption and decay. Corpse Taker. Molly's duel with the Corpse Taker was still underway. Butters's body lay at Molly's feet, empty of life and movement. And his shade, now I could see that it was bound into near immobility by threads of the Corpse Taker's dark magic, stood exactly as he had when I last saw him, staring down at his own body in horror. Down here, in the electrical junction room, Murphy and the wolves were bound with threads of the same dark magic as Butters, a sleeping spell that had compelled them all into insensibility. Molly whimpered, drawing my gaze back to the top of the stairs as her legs gave way. She slid slowly down the wall, her eyes rolling wildly. Her mouth started moving more surely, her voice becoming stronger and darker. For about 2 seconds, one of the Corpse Taker's hate-filled laughs rolled from Molly's lips. That hideous, slimy mass began to simply ooze into the young woman's skin.
Do something, I said to Uriel. He shook his head. I cannot interfere.
This battle was Molly's choice. She knew the risks and chose to hazard them.
She isn't strong enough, I snapped. She can't take on that thing.
Uriel arched an eyebrow. Were you under the impression that she did not know that from the beginning, Harry? Yet she did it.
Because she feels guilty, I said. Because she blames herself for my death. She's in the same boat I was.
No, Uriel said. None of the fallen twisted her path.
No, that was me, I said. But only because one of them got to me.
Nonetheless, Uriel said, that choice was yours and hers.
You're just going to stand there, I asked.
Uriel folded his arms and tapped his chin with one fingertip. It does seem that perhaps she deserves some form of aid. Perhaps if I'd had the presence of mind to see to it that some sort of agent had been sent to balance the scales, to give her that one tiny bit of encouragement, that one flicker of inspiration that turned the tide.
He shook his head sadly. Things might be different now.
And, as if on cue, Mortimer Lindquist, ectomancer, limped out of the lower hallway and into the electrical junction room with Sir Stewart's shade at his right hand. Mort took a look around, his dark eyes intent, and then his gaze locked onto Molly.
Hey, he croaked. You, arrogant bitch ghost.
Molly's eyes snapped fully open and flicked to Mort. They were filled with more bitter, venomous hate than my apprentice could ever have put into them.
I'm not really into this whole hero thing, Mort said. Don't have the temperament for it. Don't know a lot about the villain side of the equation either.
He planted his feet, facing the corpse taker squarely, his hands clenched into fists at his side.
But it would seem to me, you half-wit, that you probably shouldn't have left a freaking ectomancer a pit full of wraiths to play with.
And with a howl, more than 1,000 wraiths came boiling around the corner in a cloud of clawing hands, gnashing teeth, and screaming hunger. They rode on a wave of Mort's power and no longer drifted with lazy, disconnected grace. Now they came forth like rushing storm clouds, like racing wolves, like hungry sharks, a tide of mindless destruction. I saw Molly's eyes widen, and the pulsing spiritual mass that was the corpse taker began to pull away from the young woman. My apprentice didn't let her. Molly let out a wheezing cackle, and both hands formed into claws that clutched at the air. I saw the energy of her own magic surround her fingers, so that she grasped onto the corpse taker's essence as if it had been a nearly physical thing. The necromancer's spirit began to ooze through Molly's grip. The exhausted girl could only slow the corpse taker down. But it was enough. The tide of wraiths slammed into the corpse taker like a freight train, their wails blending into a sound that I had heard before in the train tunnel where Carmichael saved me. The corpse taker had begun to resume her usual form the instant she disengaged from Molly, and I could see the sudden shock and horror in her beautiful eyes as that spiritual tide overwhelmed her. I saw her struggle uselessly as the wraith train carried her up the stairs and out into the night. The train swept her straight up into the air and then reversed itself and slammed her down into the earth. I saw her try to scream. But all I heard was the blaring howl of the horn of a southbound train, and then she was gone.
You're right, Uriel said, his tone filled with a chill satisfaction. Someone needed to do something.
He glanced aside at me, gave me a slight bow of his head, and said, Well done. Mort limped up the stairs to check on Molly.
You're the one who called to me, eh?
Molly looked up at him, obviously too exhausted to move more than her head.
Harry, well, it's sort of complicated to explain what was going on, but he told me you could help.
Guess he was right, Mort said.
Where is he?
Molly asked. I mean, his ghost.
Mort glanced around and looked right at me, right through me. He shook his head.
Not here.
Molly closed her eyes and began to cry quietly.
I got her, boss,
Molly said quietly.
We got her, and I'm still here, still me. Thank you.
She's thanking me, I said quietly, for that. And much more, Uriel said. She still has her life, her future, her freedom. You did save her, you know. The idea to have her call to Mortimer in the closing moments of the psychic battle was inspired.
I've cost her too much, I said quietly.
I believe that when you went after your daughter, you said something about letting the world burn. That you and your daughter would roast marshmallows. I nodded bleakly. It is one thing for you to say, let the world burn. It is another to say, let Molly burn. The difference is all in the name.
Yeah, I croaked. I'm starting to realize that. Too late to do any good, but I get it.
Uriel gave me a steady look and said nothing. I shook my head. Get some rest, kid.
I called, though I knew she wouldn't hear me. You've earned it.
The scene unfolded. Murphy and the wolves woke up less than a minute after the corpse taker was shown to the door. Will and company changed back to their human forms, while Mort, after a whispered tip from Sir Stuart, rushed over to Butters's fallen body. He worked a subtle, complex magic that made some of mine look pretty crude, and drew Butters's spirit from the disintegrating tangle of the corpse taker's spell and back down into his physical body. It took several minutes, and when Butters woke up, Andy and Marcy, both naked, both rather pleasant that way, were giving him CPR. They'd kept his body alive in the absence of his soul.
Wow,
Butters slurred as he opened his eyes. He looked back and forth between the two werewolf girls.
Subtract the horrible pain in my chest, this migraine, and all the mold and mildew, and I'm living the dream.
Then he passed out. The cops showed up a bit after that. Two of them were guys Murphy knew. The werewolves vanished into the night a couple of seconds before the blue bubbles of the cop cars showed up, taking the illegal portions of Murphy's armament with them. Murphy and Mort told them all about how Mort had been abducted and tortured by the Big Hoods, and if they didn't tell the whole story, what they did tell was 100% true. Molly and Butters got handed off to EMTs, along with several of the Big Hoods who had been knocked around and chewed up. Mort got some attention, too, though he refused to be taken to a hospital. The rest of the Big Hoods got a pair of cuffs and a ride downtown. Boz was carted out like a tranquilized rhinoceros. Karen and Mort stood around outside as the uniform sorted everything out, and I walked over to stand close enough to hear them.
"Came back to help," Mort said. "It happens sometimes. Some people die feeling that something was incomplete. I guess Dresden thought that he hadn't done enough to make a difference around here."
Mort shook his head.
"As if that big goon didn't turn everything upside down whenever he showed up."
Karen smiled faintly and shook her head. "He always said you knew ghosts. You're sure it was really him?" Mort eyed her.
"Me and everyone else, yeah."
Karen scowled and stared into the middle distance. Mort frowned and then his expression softened.
"You didn't want it to be his ghost, did you?"
Murphy shook her head slowly but said nothing.
"You needed everyone to be wrong about it, because if it really was his ghost," Mort said, "it means that he really is dead."
Murphy's face just crumpled. Her eyes overflowed and she bowed her head. Her body shook in silence. Mort chewed on his lip for a moment, then glanced at the cops on the scene. He didn't say anything else to Murphy or try to touch her, but he did put himself between her and everyone else so that no one would see her crying. Damn. I wished I'd been bright enough to see what kind of guy Morty was while I was still alive. I stood there watching Karen for a moment and then turned away. It hurt too much to see her in pain when I couldn't reach out and touch her, or make an off-color joke, or find some way to give her a creative insult, or otherwise show her that I cared. It didn't seem fair that I should get to say goodbye to her, even if she couldn't hear it. She hadn't gotten to say it to me. So I didn't say anything. I gave her a last look, and then I walked away. I went back over to Uriel to find him conversing with Sir Stuart.
"Don't know," Sir Stuart was saying. "I'm not as right as I used to be, sir."
"There's more than enough left to rebuild on," Uriel said. "Trust me. The ruins of a spirit like Sir Stuart's are more substantial than most men ever manage to dredge up. I'd be very pleased to have you working for me."
"My descendant," Sir Stuart said, frowning over at Morty.
Uriel watched Mort shielding Karen's sorrow and said, "You've watched over him faithfully, Stuart. And he's grown a great deal in the past few years. I think he's going to be fine." Sir Stuart's shade looked at Mortimer and smiled, undeniable pride in his features. Then he glanced at Uriel and said, "I still get to fight, aye?" Uriel gave him a very sober look and said, "I think I can find you something." Sir Stuart thought about it for a moment and then nodded.
"Aye, sir, aye. I've been in this town too long. A new billet is just what I need.
Uriel looked past Sir Stuart to me and winked.
Excellent, he said, and shook hands with Sir Stuart. A man named Carmichael will be in touch.
I lingered until everyone had vanished into the thick mist that still cloaked the earth. It took less time than it usually did for these sorts of things. No one had died. No need to call in the lab guys. The uniform cops closed the old metal door as best they could, drew a big X over it with crime scene tape, and seemed willing to ignore the hole that had been blasted in it.
They're going to be all right, you know, Uriel said quietly. Tonight's injuries will not be lethal to any of them.
Thank you, I said, for telling me that. He nodded.
Have you decided?
I shook my head.
Show me my brother.
He arched an eyebrow at me, then he shrugged, and once again offered his hand. We vanished from the night and appeared in a very expensively furnished apartment. I recognized my brother's place at once. It had changed a bit. The brushed steel decor had been softened. The old Broadway musical posters had been replaced with paintings, mostly pastoral landscapes, that provided an interesting counterpoint of warmth to the original style of the place. Candles and other decorative pieces had filled in the rather Spartan spaces, I remembered, adding still more warmth. All in all, the place looked a lot more like a home now, a lot less like a dressed stage. A couple of things were out of place. There was a chair in the living room, positioned in front of the large flat-screen high-definition television set the size of a dining room table. The chair was upholstered in brown leather and looked comfortable, and it didn't match the rest of the room. There were also food stains on it. Empty liquor bottles littered the side table next to it. The door opened, and my brother, Thomas, walked in. He might have been an inch under 6 feet tall, though it was hard for me to tell. He had worn so many different kinds of fashionable shoes that his height was always changing subtly. He had dark hair, currently as long as my shortest finger, and it was a mess. Not only was it messy, it was simply messy, instead of attractively messy, and for Thomas, that was hideous. He had a couple of weeks' growth of beard, not long enough to be an actual beard yet, but too long to be a sexy shadow. His cold gray eyes were sunken, with dark rings beneath them. He wore jeans and a t-shirt with drink stains on it. He hadn't even pretended to need a coat against the night's cold, and breaking their easily maintained cover as human beings was something that the vampires of the White Court simply did not do. For God's sake, he was barefoot. He just walked out like that, apparently to the nearest liquor store. My brother took a bottle of whiskey, expensive whiskey, from a paper bag and let the bag fall to the floor. Then he sat down in the brown leather chair, pointed a remote at the television, and clicked it on. He clicked buttons and it skipped through several channels. He stopped clicking, based apparently on his need to take a drink, and stopped on some kind of sports channel where they were playing rugby. Then he simply sat, slugged from the bottle, and stared. It's hard for the half-born, Uriel observed in a quiet, neutral tone.
What did you call him?
I asked, belligerently. Which probably wasn't really bright, but Thomas was my brother. I didn't like the thought of anyone judging him. The science of mortals and immortals, Uriel said, unperturbed. Halflings, half-bloods, half-born. The mortal road is difficult enough without adding a share of our burdens to it as well. I grunted. That skinwalker got hold of him a while back. It broke something in him. The Negloshi feel a need to prove that every creature they meet is as flawed and prone to darkness as they themselves prove to be, Uriel said. It gives them some measure of false peace, I think, to lie to themselves like that.
You sound like you feel sorry for them, I said, my voice hard.
I feel sorry for all the pain they have, and more so for all that they inflict on others. Your brother offers ample explanation for my feelings. What that thing did to Thomas, how is that different from what the Fallen did to me?
He didn't die as a result, Uriel said bluntly.
He still has choice. He added in a softer voice, "What the Negloshi did to him was not yours."